We're working in 1 John, and first of all, I've got a number of introductory comments to make, as you see on the left-hand side, and then we're going to go through the book. I am not sure how much I can cover, because I have not tried to do this before in 1 hour. So what may be happening here is that there's too much stuff all at once, and it may go too fast. But if we get to the end of the hour and we haven't finished the whole thing, that's just the way it'll be. I would rather try too much than try too little with you, and so we're just going to roll on kind of fast here. First of all, some introductory comments. The book of 1 John you memorized in confirmation class, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and those were three books that you could remember those, right? It's at the back of the New Testament, and 1 John is the longest one you know, and 2nd and 3rd John are very short. They're called general epistles or Catholic epistles. That is, Catholic with a small c, meaning general or to the whole church. Other general letters are Hebrews, and the book of James is a general letter, and a few others, Jude, for example. So what we've got here is not a specific Pauline-type letter to the Corinthians or to the Galatians, but rather we've got a general letter addressed to no one in particular and everyone in general. And because of that, we've got more problems with the book of 1 John, at least trying to understand some of the specifics of it, than we would have with other letters. It's a general letter, and one of the theories about this general letter is that when the traveling missionary hopped on the horse and went to Asia Minor to preach, they had to take along something. They didn't have Luther's Catechism to take along or the small called articles or anything else like that. So they had to take something with them on their missionary journeys. What could they take with them as their own training device and as something that they could read to the congregations in the year 100 as the gospel was spreading out? What could they use? Well, one of the theories is that the book of 1 John, this short general epistle, is kind of a traveling catechism. It's a little sermon or a compendium of the Christian faith in a very brief kind of way that traveling missionaries could take with them. That's one of the theories that we have about 1 John. It's not necessarily the only one. The author of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John and the author of the Gospel of John and the author of the Book of Revelation for centuries and centuries were understood to be the very same person. That is, the disciple that Jesus loved. That theory held up for a long, long time until it was closely examined a number of years ago, late 19th century, and early in this century. And now the question about who wrote 1 John and if the gospel writer of John and the book of Revelation were all written by the same person, that's very much up for grabs. It could safely be said, and most everyone would agree, that the book of Revelation is not written by the same person that wrote the Gospel of John, and 1st and 2nd John may have been written by the writer of the Gospel of John, but not necessarily by the writer of the Gospel of John. So what we have in the book of 1st John, in this short letter, is a book that often echoes the Gospel of John in much of the picture, the language that's used, and the theology and the emphasis is often echoed from the Gospel, so we could say that it's possible that 1 John was written by the same person that wrote the Gospel of John. 1 John was not written by the same person that wrote the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse of John, at the end. We can be sure of that. There's a theme in the book of 1 John, and it's kind of like education these days. Back to the basics. I want my kid to learn how to read and write. You know, I don't want him to learn how to make pottery in school. I want him to learn how to write. So it's back to basics, and all the school principals are hustling around trying to figure out how to help children learn how to read and write again. Same thing in the book of 1 John. It's back to basics. No frills, no extras, all basic stuff. And because it's a call back to the basics and a review of the basics, therefore it's been understood, that's one of the reasons why it's been understood to be sort of a traveling companion of an early missionary, kind of an early catechism as such. In the whole of 1 John, one of the problems that we have is, in reading it, there are no names, no illustrations. It's just like a sermon that you can hardly, you know, 20 minutes and there's no stories or anything, and you're just struggling to stay with it, you know. There's no illustrations, no names, no references to people, places, things, or anything. It's all a book about ideas. Light, truth, love, joy, confidence. Okay. You just, by the third chapter or so, you're just hoping somewhere there's got to be an illustration in here or a story or something to give you a little breathing space. There isn't. A book of ideas straight on through. The book of 1 John presents a series of tests. Litmus paper, it was in ninth grade, wasn't it? When you stuck the litmus paper in the solution, and if it was yellow, it was something, and if it was blue, if it was something else, or whatever the litmus paper test is, acid and base. The book of 1 John is a litmus paper test of the faith. Call back to basics. The basics are that if there is faith in the true God and His Son Jesus Christ, then our behavior will show it. It's a litmus paper test to examine whether or not our lives are in fact following the one true faith. And if our lives are following the one true faith, then we will behave in a certain manner. That's the litmus paper test that we're looking at in the book of 1 John. The date is probably between 100 and 110, somewhere in there. Two big ideas that the writer of 1 John will talk about some possible ideas about who the person was in just a second. Two big ideas that the writer of 1 John is working on or working against. And picture it like this. The Lutheran Church has just decided for the first time in history to build a mission church and to start a mission in Salt Lake City. All right. You got a couple problems right off the start there. This church starts in Salt Lake City. And there are four families and a pastor. And somebody who doesn't live in Salt Lake is kind of responsible for this mission in Salt Lake City. Well, after the first 6 months, things are moving along, and the first year things are happening, and there is some progress in the church. But then word comes back that this Lutheran congregation in Salt Lake City is becoming very interested in genealogy. All right, that's okay. But for what purpose? And to baptize the dead or just to know who your relatives are? Okay, that's an important question. So what happens is that the board of mission or whoever set up this church in Salt Lake gets more and more reports back about stuff that sounds a little funny going on in this Lutheran congregation in Salt Lake City. Same thing is going on with the writer of 1 John. There's some issues that are developing in the church at that time that the writer of 1 John is trying to counteract, trying to work against. And they are. You may have heard the words, you may have not heard the words before. The two words are Gnosticism and Docetism. All right, they're not that big of a deal. They are important, but they're not that difficult to explain. So first of all, Docetism. No, let's start with Gnosticism. Gnosticism is the idea that the physical world is bad. That is, your body is bad, and this hood is bad, and these rocks are bad, and all the physical world is bad. And that if we would be saved, if we would somehow get away from the physical, the only way to do it is through knowledge. Gnosis is knowledge, special knowledge. So if you get this special knowledge in your head, you can get saved. You can float away from the bad world that you're in. Does that sound familiar? It really is Gnosticism is an ancient idea, but it's also very common today. That somehow if you get Jesus, you float away. That you get the knowledge of the Lord, and then all your body doesn't bother you anymore, and your family doesn't bother you, and the church, nothing bothers you anymore. You kind of get away from it all. You get saved that way. Well, Gnosticism was the idea that the real world was bad, but ideas, being saved through ideas and through special knowledge. Not everybody has it. It's a special little thing, see, this knowledge. And then you get saved and taken away by it. 1 John is trying to counteract that. The other thing it's trying to counteract is Docetism. Docetism is the idea that Jesus really wasn't a person, that he was just kind of looked like a person, but he really wasn't a person. And he seemed to be. Docetism is the idea that something seems to be what it really isn't. Jesus just seemed to be in a body, but he really was not in a body. There's a story told about, it's probably not a true story, but it's an interesting one, that one of the proponents of this docetic heresy, that Jesus really wasn't in a body, but just was kind of a ghost, that this proponent of this heresy in the early church was in a bathhouse, and so in some city in the ancient world, and that the old man, John, the disciple that Jesus loved, who was the author of 1 John, was in the same bathhouse with this proponent of this heresy. And somebody came up to John and said, "Do you know who's in this bathhouse with you? It's this Sertius fella who is proposing this docetic heresy." And old John is so upset that this heretic is in the same bathhouse with him that he runs out bare naked, because he's afraid that that God's going to call down the wrath of the angels and the whole thing's going to collapse and he's going to be caught dead in this bathhouse with this heretic. Anyway, that's an old story in the church. So he runs out and he doesn't want to have anything to do with this kind of heretic. What we've got is a call back to the basics. Basically, that Jesus has come in the flesh, that the love of God means that we are going to behave in a certain way, and that that our behavior really does matter. If in confirmation class you had to memorize verses from the scriptures in order to be confirmed or whatever, it's likely that some of the verses you had to memorize were from 1 John. We've got a book here that is not organized very well. So for us to study it like we would study Paul, or like Walt did last week with 1 Corinthians, part 1, part 2, this outline up here is very arbitrary. 1 John is not well organized. Rather, it is cyclical. Walt chose the title for this morning, Spiraling in 1 John, which basically means that things just kind of go around in a circle in this book. It's not a clear, logical book. But it is a book that's full of all sorts of quotable quotes, and in confirmation you probably had to memorize some of them. Like, for example, "If we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another." You maybe had to memorize that. Or, "We love because he first loved us." Or, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that overcomes the world, our faith." Or, "He who has the Son has the life, he who has not the Son has not the life." Or, "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our life for the brethren." Or, "If anyone sees a brother committing..." It was the other one over here. "We love because he first loved us." Okay. There's quote after quote in the book of 1 John that's memorable and probably is a part of your spiritual life somewhere back there. But it's not a clearly organized book. So what we have to do then is not worry about an outline as we go through it, but rather try to pick up some of the major themes. That's the introduction. Catholic epistle, a general one. It's a tract carried by early itinerant preachers. The author is probably the aged John. The date was about the year 100 to 110. The theme is back to basics. It's ideas and not concrete material. Tests of the faith. The tests basically are, if you say you love Jesus, well then let's see it in your behavior. That's the test. And return to fundamentals. It's like an education today. Oh, and it's a positive book. With all the docetic heresy and the Gnostic heresy and all the other problems that they're having in the church, the writer of 1 John approaches all of those problems in a very positive kind of way. And finally, it's cyclical. It's not organized in a logical kind of way. The prologues, the first four verses, we'll look at that first. And then we'll kind of, I don't know if you've got, everybody have a copy of the scriptures or not, but it's over there. We'll look at that first. Prologue, first four. Third verse is going to be the key here. And this is going to echo the Gospel of John. Okay, in the beginning was the Word. Listen to this. "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the Word of life, the life was made manifest. We saw it, testified to it, proclaimed to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship was with the Father and with his Son. And we are writing this that our joy may be complete." First line, notice what John does. Very beginning of the book, he goes after the idea that Jesus really wasn't a person, that he was just a ghost, the docetic heresy. Notice what he says. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard with our ears, we've seen it with our eyes, we've looked upon it, and we've touched it with our hands. No ghost do we believe in. And when we saw him, we heard him, we touched him. Real person, the Jesus that we believe in. And this has been made manifest to us. We saw it, we testify to you that this is what we've seen, and we proclaim to you eternal life. And the third verse is kind of the theme for the whole thing. That which we have seen and which we have heard, we now proclaim also to you, so that you may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and with the Son. The purpose for the whole thing is to say, as it says in verse 3, that we may have fellowship. Fellowship with each other and fellowship with God. The purpose of the book is to say that our being together at Holden or in our congregations is the goal for seeing Jesus. What's it for? It's to have us together. Bonhoeffer writes that the purpose of a congregation is to share the gospel, and the purpose of the congregation is also to proclaim the gospel that has been shared within the congregation. That's what we have here. And in the fourth verse, so that we can be happy. Joy. So that your joy may be complete. All right. There it is. We've seen Jesus. He's real. And we believe it, and because of that, we have joy. Now, I'm going to start in the fifth verse, and what we're doing is going to the fifth verse of the first chapter, and that section, this next section, runs all the way through the 17th verse of the second chapter. All right? So that's quite a little ways. And what we have in this section from 1:5 to 2:17 are some ethical tests for fellowship with God. Ethical tests for fellowship with God. The litmus paper test. All right. How should we test our faith? Somebody gives 10% of their income to the church, and they understand that to be a test of their faith. Somebody else speaks in tongues, and that's a test, they say, of their faith. That shows that their faith is for real. Someone else has a positive attitude about life, and that the business will succeed. And they say that my positive attitude is an example that I believe in Jesus. That's kind of a Robert Schuller thing from Southern California. Others say that an example of the fact that I truly believe in Jesus is that my theology is good. You know, I don't believe any heresies. That means I believe in Jesus. We had a group up here this past winter who, and their emphasis was just really one of the most surprising I've ever heard. They had lectures for men and for women, and the lectures for the women were on cuticle care, getting in and out of cars, sitting correctly. And it was all very serious, absolutely serious. And this person was presenting this. There was 100 people over in the village center. It was a strange thing. The point of it was that if you look pretty and your cuticles are squared away, then everyone's going to say, "Why are your cuticles so nice?" See? And then you'll say, "Well, because I love Jesus." I mean, it was the strangest thing I've ever seen. But it really caused quite a furor around here for a few days, as you could well imagine. Well, there we are. There's a test of the faith. Because I believe in Jesus, I mean, I'm going to look good, I'm going to take care of my cuticles, and all sorts of stuff. There's lots of ways to test the faith. The money you give, and not all these are valid ways of testing whether your faith is for real or not. But I mean, there's many ways in which we will evaluate ourselves and evaluate others, and we have to do that, I guess, to see whether or not faith is for real. What 1 John is doing is offering us a way to test the faith, and it's not cuticles or anything like that. What he's going to do, and he works like music now. He plays a song, and the song keeps repeating itself. Okay, it kind of keeps coming and going. The theme weaves in and out of the piece. John's question in 1:5, and you'll kind of look along as I mention some verses, please. John's question in 1:5 is, you say you are a Christian. That's wonderful. Now let's see if you are or not. Let's find some proof for it. He's not being critical or cynical. John is simply saying, that's fine. I'm glad you're a Christian. Now let's test that. Let's do a litmus paper test on your faith. And what is the test that John wants to impose upon us and suggest to us? It is to say, is your moral behavior following your faith in Christ? That's the test that John's going to offer to us here. God, he starts out by saying in the 5th chapter, God is light. Here John is being very mystical. I mean, how else do you talk about God? God is light. That's a very mystical statement. But notice in the 8th verse already, it turns from this mystical element to a very practical element. If we say we have no sin, then we are deceiving ourselves. There is an ethical element in the 5th chapter, the 5th verse of the 8th verse of the 1st chapter, excuse me. So it moves from the mystical in the 5th verse to the ethical in the 8th verse. John is saying, if you say you love Jesus, let's see it in moral behavior. How should religious experiences be evaluated? I mean, if we say we walk in the garden alone, when the dew is still on the roses, how do we evaluate the mystical religious experiences that we have? Well, John is simply saying that the way to evaluate our religious experiences is in our behavior. One of the hard things to do today is to evaluate other people's religious experiences, especially if those religious experiences are mystical in nature. A mystical pietist will frequently say that my religious experience is, you can't evaluate my experience because I had it alone with Jesus. And there's nobody that can evaluate it but me. John says that that's not true. John is saying that our religious experiences are very public because they show them, the result of those experiences are seen in our behavior. If we do not have this litmus paper test that John is asking for in the first chapter here, that is our behavior, we'll have to find other ways to evaluate our religious experience. And all of those are risky. Some of them could be emotions. I mean, we're extremely emotional about our faith, and somehow that's supposed to be the test of it. That's risky. Another way to evaluate faith is by liturgical formalism. I mean, sometimes I wonder about liturgical renewal in the church. Incense and a lot of pompous pastors sometimes. And I wonder if that might be a way of avoiding a more biblical analysis of our faith. In other words, we can be chancel prancers and walk all around with fully regaled robes and just look absolutely delightful. But I'm not sure that that's a biblical way of evaluating the character of our faith. I believe in liturgics and a liturgical style of worship and life. I really do, very strongly. I'm just saying that emotions are not a way to evaluate faith. Liturgical formalism is also a risky way to evaluate faith. And doctrinal legalism. I believe in the catechism, or I have a pure faith. I believe in the Bible. What's that all mean? John says that those kind of evaluations that we do on ourselves or on others in the church really don't make it. The only one that really makes it is behavior. Let's see how you live. It's being positive about it. Notice, please, in the eighth verse there of first chapter, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. Yesterday Walt Bowman talked about the services of confession in the new hymnal. And some of you were here, but a great many of you were not. One of the things that he said yesterday that was very exciting and interesting to me was the possibility of renewing within a congregation the element of private confession. That is, there are certain hours where private confession is heard in a congregation. And the pastor is there to hear it. There's a discussion about if only the pastor can do it, but that's the way it's in the hymnal anyway. There's hours for private confession, and there's special worship services for confession, just for confession. And he told a story of a family that was fighting over an inheritance. A farm was sold, and the children were mad because the price was too cheap. And there was a confessional service where all the brothers and sisters and everybody got together for that service of confession. Bonhoeffer writes in one of his books that a pious fellowship will not permit people to be sinful. I think that's important. John is saying to us here in the 8th verse of the 1st chapter that if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. The new hymnal, one of the beauties of it, is a renewed emphasis on confession and forgiveness, the services of confession and forgiveness. And that's an exciting part of what we have in that new book. And that service of confession and forgiveness leads us into behavior, a correct behavior. Now, in the 2nd chapter, he moves on with the same theme of ethical behavior. He's talking about walking in the light. My little children, picture the old John now, okay? My little children, I am writing this to you so that you may not sin, but if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous, and he is the expiation for our sins, not only for ours also, but for the sins of the whole world. Expiation. Do you have to memorize that word in confirmation? I was one, gave my 7th and 8th graders tests, and one of the things they had to, what is expiation? You know, well, that's a tough word. We don't use that word very much anymore. There may be a better word than expiation for our sins. It is that Jesus is the one who cleanses us. Defilement is perhaps a better word. That Jesus is the one who cleans us off. We are defiled by sin, and he cleans us off. Now, about that, one thing I think that's happened here within the past year is very interesting at the village. Normally, I have understood that what Jesus did in his life and death and cross and resurrection, no, what Jesus did was to give me expiation or to wash me off, to cleanse me of the guilt of my sins. And that's true. But in addition to that, one of the things that I've been trying to learn here this past year is that the washing off has not to do with just my eternal life, but has to do with my daily life. That the washing of me that Jesus did is for my eternal salvation, that's true. But it's also to show me how to live every day right now, and that he is the way we are to live right now, every day. That his way is the way for daily living. The implications of that are immense, obviously. In the 3rd through the 5th verses, he's repeating the same thing. And by this we may be sure that we know him if we keep his commandments. He who says, I know him, but disobeys his commandments is a liar. The truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, in him truly love for God is perfected. By this we can be sure we are in him. He who says he abides in him ought to walk in the same way in which Jesus walked. Okay. I don't know if you've seen this big thing or not. It's a proof text for 1 John, in a way. This is called A Study of Generations. And Lutheran Brother, anybody have Lutheran Brotherhood Insurance? This is not a sales pitch for Lutheran Brotherhood Insurance. This is just to say that those folks funded this study. It's called A Study of Generations. Merton Strumman and a number of other researchers, mostly from the University of Minnesota, tried to figure out what Lutherans believed. So they studied 5,000 Lutherans, and this was done a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, a 2-year study of 5,000 Lutherans between the ages of 15 and 65. Basically, the question was, does it really make any difference if you believe in Jesus or not? In addition, they also wanted to find out how much money we had, what kind of houses we lived in, what kind of cars we drove, and where we went to school, and all that kind of stuff. It's a very interesting profile of Lutherans. Well, one of the things it does is to confirm what we're talking about in 1 John. That is, if you believe in Jesus, you're going to be different people. You're going to act differently. For example, they found that 2 out of 5 Lutherans were really Jews. That 2 out of 5 Lutherans were, and that's really that's not an accurate statement. I'll take that statement back, because I think the Jewish people understand grace. So let's take that statement back. 2 out of 5 people are legalists. That is, that they believe that there is a ladder by which we climb to heaven. Confirmation, Sunday school, you know, all that. We do all of our stuff and then God loves us. 3 out of 5 Lutherans, they concluded from their 2-year study, believe the gospel. That is, that we are saved by God's unmerited love of us, by his grace. We receive that by faith. All right. So then they asked the next question. Of these 2 out of 5 Lutherans who basically are legalists, what else do they believe in? Well, for example, they believe in racism. How's that? They also believe in a lot of other things that we wouldn't all be real proud to confess we believed in. 3 out of 5 that are grace-oriented people have different behavior patterns. They spend their money differently. They have different attitudes towards other races. They have different attitudes toward political matters. They have different attitudes towards all of life. In other words, what we believe makes a difference in how we behave. 1 John is simply saying that. That if you love Jesus, your behavior changes. And that's what Merton Straumann and these folks with their... the review of this thing got in Time magazine, which was kind of interesting. And if I recall, it was just a short little thing in the religion section. And if I recall it correctly, they said that it was an interesting study because it tied together for the first time in a kind of hard statistical kind of way the relationship between behavior and faith. And that was something that few people had ever believed was possible, that your faith really affected your behavior. Straumann says that, and of course that's what 1 John is all about too. Now, we are in the seventh verse of the second chapter. There's some more ethical tests of faith there. We'll have to skip those. It's in a way a repeat from 2:7 through 2:11. It's a repeat, a re-echoing of the theme that has been played before. Now down in 2:12 to 2:17, John is addressing the question of why this letter is written. See the reference there in 2:12, 2:13, and 2:14. To you, my children, to you, fathers, to you, young men. No women were in leadership positions in the early church. That's why there's no reference here to women. And in 15, do not love the world. That's a problematical statement. John 3:16 says, for God so loved the world. But now, here we have in 2:15, don't love the world. Well, we understand world in two different ways here. God so loved the world, his whole creation, and you and me and everything in it. Yes, that's true. Don't love the world means don't love the things that are evil in the world. Love the Creator, but don't fall in love with all the adiaphora. A part of it. So what we do there at the 17th verse of the second chapter is end the first section, ethical tests for fellowship with God. And we're still back to where we started, and that is to say for yourself, how do you answer the question, do you believe in Jesus? I don't know that I have any traditional gifts of the Spirit like prophecy or speaking in tongues. I don't have any of those. So I can't say I believe in Jesus because I do that. When I handle my money, I hope that shows that I believe in Jesus. John wants us to say that our behavior will reflect very clearly whether or not we love the Lord or not. So, now, Antichrist, this is a hot one. 2:18 to 2:27, a small section, but it stands on its own. 2:18, children, it is the last hour. Have you heard that on the radio? Yes, you have. Children, it's the last hour. And as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. It was obvious in the year 100 that they did expect Jesus to be back soon. And we are still waiting for that. So we can say, that their understanding that Christ's imminent return was very, very close at hand is not what really happened. Okay. Antichrists have come, therefore we know that it is the last hour. The Antichrists went out from us, but they were not of us, for if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out, they left the church, that it might be plain that they all are not of us. But you have been anointed by the Holy One, and you all know. Now, some interesting word plays going on here. Antichrists. Antichrists. In the Greek, what is it? Antichristos. There are many Antichristoses around. Antichrists. And John has a wordplay down in the 20th verse. You see the word anointed? In the Greek, that is chrisma. Okay? There's lots of anti-chrismas around, but you've got the chrisma. Okay? They were hearing it in Greek, and they could hear the kind of poetic wordplay that's going on. Anti-chrismas all over the place, but you got the real chrisma. All right? You understand what's going on there? He's doing a little wordplay with the Greek, and it's kind of fun. Jesus isn't back yet, and the second coming hasn't happened. They were waiting for it at the time. Some people believe that the Gospel of Mark was written to explain why Jesus had not come back yet. But that was the situation. They were waiting, but it hadn't happened. Now we know that in our time and through the history of the church, the second coming of Christ has brought about more difficulty and more strange and, fairly, more interesting behavior and more interesting religious groups and theology than probably any other one issue. We are all excited about the future, and it's a natural curiosity that we have about the future. But the perversions that have been foisted off on the church by those, I'm sure, well-meaning, who somehow believed that they could foresee the future and tell when Christ was coming back, when the Antichrists were around and all of that, have caused no small bit of trouble. I would suggest that one of the books that you needn't read is The Late Great Planet Earth. And this simply isn't a good book. It is a book that describes the second coming of Christ. And it does so in very factual and very seemingly very objective terms. The Late Great Planet Earth is not new. It's one of many ways of understanding the book of Revelation and the second coming of Christ. It is a book that is based on the dispensationalist theory in the book of Revelation, which is an old theory. It's just reworked with a new cover. It's not any more accurate than any of the rest. In fact, it is very inaccurate. But it's an extremely popular book because, for some reason, the cycle comes and goes through the generations in the history of the church. The cycle about being interested in the second coming of Christ. And Hal Lindsey, it's just, the movie was in Chelan recently. I don't know if any of you saw the movie. I hope not a lot of you did. But it isn't a good book because it isn't accurate biblically. But it plays a lot on this Antichrist theme. While Hal Lindsey is waiting for the coming of Christ, he's driving a Maserati in Southern California. But anyway, if you're waiting for Jesus, you just will have a good time while you're waiting. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway. Notice the 18th verse, please. Talking about the enemies of Christ.
You were told they were coming, and so it is.
And so it is true. The antichrists through the history of the world have been many. Luther was called an antichrist. The Pope has been understood to be an antichrist. Hitler, Roosevelt, Harry Truman was an antichrist. All sorts of people have been identified as the antichrist. And in our own time, Jim Jones, I mean, what can you say? You know, or Reverend Moon, talk about antichrists, antichristmas, huh? There they are, right there. But pinning one down and saying, well, now the antichrist has arrived, and we are ready for the second coming of Christ, that's something else again. In the 20th verse, there's a beautiful thing that happens. One of the heresies and one of the problems that 1 John, I said at the beginning, was fighting against was the idea that you had to have some special knowledge. You know, you had to have this secret wisdom in order to escape from this evil world. Well, the writer of 1 John in the 20th verse there says, you know, you get that? You know everything. Do you see it? You don't need a special, deeper, inner, hidden, secret wisdom that nobody else is privileged to. The gospel is simple. You know everything, he says. You don't have to have some sort of special, secret insight into something that no one else can have. And no one else has. And I think there's a lot of Gnosticism around today where people would claim that unless you have some sort of special knowledge, that you will not be saved or carried away. Not so, says 1 John. It's very simple, the gospel. You know everything, he writes. And in the 22nd verse, it slips by us, but it's important. Who is the liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? Jesus was a person, had a body. Well, the Docetus said Jesus was the Christ. That Jesus didn't really have a body. He was kind of a ghost. Not so, says 1 John. Jesus, the carpenter, the one with the body, he is the Christ, refuses to let us escape from the incarnation. That's what's happening in the 22nd. And then 26 and 27 are kind of a repeat of the above. Now, we start a third major section, and it's not a logical section, remember. It's another part. And it starts in 2:28 and it runs all through the third chapter. And the theme of this section is that the children of God are faithful children and they are also sure of what they believe in. The major theme you'll see there in the first verse of the third chapter. Children of God.
We see what love the Father has given us, that we should be called the children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know is that it does not know him. John is going back to the basics, back to the ultimates. He is trying to tell us where we've come from. You've studied Darwin's Origin of the Species. Where have we come from? You know, crawled out of the ooze. Okay, that's one way of trying to understand where we've come from. This book of 1 John is trying to understand where we have come from. What's the origin of the faith and origin of Christians? And in order to explain that, John, in a way, pulls all the stops in that first line of the third chapter. And he says that Christians are children of God. Now, that's not an offensive statement to us because we've heard it so often. But if you'll try to live in the year 100, and if you'll try to be an ancient person who conceived God as living in the temple and as high in the sky and in fire and smoke, and then the offense of this statement can come through. John has no way to explain who we are in this fellowship other than saying we are children of the Holy One. I just believe that the people that first read this, eyes fell right on the floor when they came to the statement, we are children of God. And an obnoxious, offensive, incredible statement. True statement. But it's like a brickbat. Knocks us on the head with it. Children of God. No other way to explain our origins. The people that John was writing to felt differently. They acted differently. They talked differently. And they didn't know how to explain it. You know, I mean, if you go to college and you go home and you're different after 4 years and your mom and dad say, you're different. And you say, yeah, I am different. I don't know why, but I'm different in a lot of ways. The people in the early church were different. They didn't know how to explain it. All their values were changed. All their way they lived was changed. Everything was changed. How do they explain how they're so different? John helps them explain it. You are children of God. Nothing else will explain the origins of their change other than to go to that extreme, to say we are children of God. Now notice, please, about the children of God. And we're going to look at 7, 8, 9, and all the rest. These children of God, in the 7th verse of the 3rd chapter, the children of God do the right things. Okay, does that sound familiar? We're back to that first part again, ethical tests. How do you know you're a Christian? Because you do certain things. You behave a certain way. The 7th verse, we're Christians, the children of God do the right things. In the 9th verse, the children of God do not continue in sin. The 10th verse, the children of God have a clear difference between gods, can understand the difference between gods and devils. 16th verse, the children of God give lives for their brothers and sisters. 17th verse, the children of God share their wealth. 18th verse, the children of God are in action. They don't just talk about it. Okay. Origin of the species, origin of the faith, children of God. And children of God do all sorts of things differently. We just listed 6. Spend their money differently, treat their brothers and sisters differently, can understand good and evil differently. All those different kinds of things are going on. Now, the 19th verse is beautiful. 3:19. By this we shall know that we are of the truth and reassure our hearts before him. Whenever our hearts condemn us, for God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. Sometimes our hearts condemn us, it says here. Sometimes we don't feel like we're a Christian. Sometimes we don't have any emotions that are Christian emotions. Sometimes everything inside of us says to us, we aren't what we want to be and claim to be. The writer of John is saying, that's just fine. Go ahead. Some days your emotions are going to fall apart. Someday your feelings about being a Christian are not going to be there. Don't bother. God's bigger than your emotions. You see that in there? Isn't that great? It would be terrible if we had to rely on our emotions all the time. To be up as Christians, John says you don't have to be up. You can feel bad. You can feel unchristian. God's bigger than how we feel. Whenever our hearts condemn us, God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. I think that's a marvelous, marvelous statement. Now we're in the 4th chapter. First 6 verses, and we're back to that testing. Well, this is not the same thing in a way. But we talked about the Antichrist. Okay, this is kind of an echo back to that. In a way, testing the faith and testing the spirits fit together. And, testing the faith here and faithful and sure here. Oh, forget what I'm saying. Antichrist and the testing of the spirits go together. We're at 4:1-6 now, testing the spirits.
Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are of God, for false prophets have come and gone out, out into the world. By this you know the spirit of truth. Every spirit which confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, not as a ghost, in the flesh. Okay, hear that statement he's making against the docetists here? And every spirit that does not confess Jesus is not of God. This is the spirit of Antichrist, of which you have heard that it was coming, and now it is already in the world. Little children, you are of God and overcome them, for he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world.
Pastors have to fill out computer things, computer reports. Is it right, Pastor? Yes. We have to fill out these little things that in the box, you know. How many members have joined this past year? 21. How many left your church? 22. How many baptisms? You have to fill out all this stuff, and then you mail it into Minneapolis or to Philadelphia or to St. Louis or wherever your headquarters is, and then it runs through the computer and it comes out, Trinity Lutheran Church, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, all the stuff. And then they mail it back. And then you open it up and you feel really bad, you know. Or you feel really good because a whole bunch of people joined or a whole bunch of people left, one or the other. And so the pastor feels bad. Either puts it in the drawer or takes it to the church council, one of the two. Some way you've got to figure out whether or not you did a good job. So John says, let's test the spirits. And the church has got to keep track of its own. So there's nothing wrong with computers and filling out all that. There's nothing. That's a good thing to do. It saves a lot of time and energy. It's a good record-keeping system. Only thing is that if you're a pastor and people leave your congregation, you feel kind of bad. In fact, you feel terrible, as a matter of fact. In fact, you just go home and cry, mostly. You know, at least a lot of the pastors I know do, because it's a terrible, painful thing to have somebody leave, because you feel really awful. Well, how do you test the spirits? It can be that a pastor can serve a congregation for 30 years and be just an absolute spellbinder, and then either die or retire, go to Palm Springs or whatever, and everybody leaves. You know. Or Oral Roberts someday can't do the TV show anymore, and his son isn't quite as good, you know, and the ratings start to go down. All right. Well, how do you test the spirits? I think 30 years is a flash in the pan. Does that sound reasonable? I think to test the effectiveness of a ministry over 30 years is much too short of a time period. In fact, maybe even 100 years is much too short of a time period. The effectiveness of a ministry is tested over, isn't it, over centuries? Well, what John is saying here is to test the spirits. Don't believe all who claim to have the Spirit. Test them to see if they are from God. And the test that he says is that we perform on each other, that we ask of each other, is, do you confess that Jesus is the Christ, that he came in the flesh in the second chapter? Anyone that denies that Jesus came in the flesh is the Antichristus. But you have the chrisma, remember that? In 3. Well, if we are to test the spirits, to test pastors or to test institutions like the Oral Roberts Institution or others that are on television now, we're going to have some way of testing the spirits other than numbers. And the way to test the spirits, John says, is to say, do you believe that Jesus is the Christ and that he came in the flesh? Notice, please, the first line of that fourth chapter. Beloved, do not believe. Oftentimes we hear believe. But John says, and John says to believe and then love. But he also says, don't believe. Gullibility is not the Christian faith, okay? Don't believe everything that comes our way. Do not believe, rather test. There's a new thing that's happening in the South Pacific District of the American Lutheran Church. Marge Wold was on the faculty here this past month, and her responsibility in the South Pacific District is to be a special assistant consultant to congregations that are in changing neighborhoods. Right? I had one of those churches in downtown San Jose. It was in a changing neighborhood. And so there were 68, I think, churches in the South Pacific District or the ALC that are in changing neighborhoods now. And more are entering that category all the time, obviously. Marge says that the state of California will be the first third world state in the United States, that the city of Los Angeles is already that in a way. And so how in a situation like that, how do we test the spirits? Well, the beautiful thing about what Marge is doing is that she's saying to the rest of the churches in the district and to the whole church that there's a different way to evaluate a ministry in downtown Los Angeles other than the computer printout. Isn't that wonderful? There's a different way to say that something is good, something good is happening in that parish other than numbers, because the numerical thing doesn't work real well in third world ministries like much of the South Pacific District is these days. So her way of saying that is by publishing a little newspaper that just reaffirms in a very positive kind of way, just like John is positive here, reaffirms in a very positive way the good stuff that's going on. Not numerically, but in many other ways. John says, test the spirits to see if they are of God. If they say that Jesus came in the flesh, then they are, if they're not. Anyway, in your own congregations, find ways to affirm the whole ministry of the church in non-numerical ways, if you can, using the criteria that John has here. 4:7 through 5:12 is a long, and we're not going to go through the whole thing, so rest easy there. Are we done? Huh? 8:45, 9:45. Yeah, okay. One last thing then. In the fourth chapter, 17th verse.
4:17. In this is love perfected with us, that we may have confidence for the day of judgment.
I'd like to center your attention on the word confidence. The word confidence in the Greek is found 31 times in the New Testament. And of those 31 times, 13 of them are in the little book of 1 John. 13 times. Be confident. Somebody is saying you don't have the secret knowledge. 1 John says you do know. You know everything. Be confident in what you know. Some people are saying you don't know the real Jesus, and 1 John is saying yes, you do. Be confident of what you already know. All right, I think that's a beautiful way to end it. Well,
the conclusion is that
5:12, and 5:12 is really the finale of the book. He who has the Son has life. He who has not the Son of God has not life. There it is right there. You'll remember the book of 1 John. The year 100, a small tract probably given to itinerant preachers. The emphasis is on behavior, ethical tests of the faith. If you say you love Jesus, then let's see it. It's positive, it's cyclical, it talks about the Antichrist. And it says that if we say we love God, then we will do something about that. And our behavior will show it, and our lives will reflect it. And he who has the Son has life. Okay, that's time for coffee, and also time for discussion. You have to have a chance to get out of here, see. So I give you the opportunity to leave now, if you'd like. And if any of you would like to stay and visit about 1 John for a bit, we can certainly do that. Thank you very much.